my name is Bonnie. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Bonnie.
And I just said to Tina, should I tell them I feel old? And she said, you know, remember God sent you here. I thought that was like right on. So my sobriety date is December 4th, 1978. In a few weeks, we'll have 36 years of continuous sobriety. And on November 29th, it will be 36 years without an injectable of narcotics. So, just as an aside. You know, I love being asked to speak, but man, I woke up this morning and said, why am I doing this? Like, why do I do this to myself? Because I get, you know, so anxious, but, and I do feel a little old, because when you're 36 years sober, that means you're 36 years older than I was when I came in. But, you know, as soon as Justin started speaking, I identified with him, because he talked about being defiant. And I was defiant when I was in camp. I went to camp every summer. I lived in New York, and I went to camp every summer. And, you know, I don't know, I must have been 13, 14, I don't know how old I was, 12. And the counselor, we had just come back from breakfast, and I was sitting on my bed talking, and I was just going to get up and make my bed. And the counselor said, Bonnie, make your bed. And I said, no. No, I refused to make my bed. And they took me to the head counselor's office, where I had to sit all day outside in this chair, and nobody was allowed to talk to me. We could stop right there. That's the story of my life. Because I always say, like, when like other people zig, I zag. You know, I cannot do what I have to, like, it's like inborn in me. But I know it's like the defiance of the alcoholic. I so identify with that. So what you see before you is a woman who has, in these 36 years, have experienced the vicissitudes of life. You know, I've lived a lifetime sober, and for me there are two lives. There's the life before sobriety, and there's the life after sobriety. The life before sobriety, I loved to drink more than I liked to do anything in the world. I had no aspiration. I come from a professional family. I mean, my father was a lawyer, my brother's a doctor, and I had absolutely no... All I wanted to do was drink, and I had no... I only went to college because my father wouldn't hear of me not going to college. It wasn't even like a discussion. He like slammed his hand on the table, and when I brought it up that maybe I wouldn't go, that was the end of the discussion. I came from a family that, you know, I call it like a European household. It was like very authoritative. It was not in the era where children had feelings and thoughts. Like, I wore a sweater when my mother was cold. It's the truth. I didn't know how to, literally, and I really mean this, I didn't know how to think until I got sober. In my first year of sobriety, I had this ashtray that I brought back from Europe. I went to school in Switzerland for a while, and I had this ashtray that I brought back from Europe, and I don't know, it broke. Probably, I don't know how, but it broke. So I went down to Ace Hardware, because I love this ashtray, and I got glue, and I came back upstairs to my apartment, and I glued it together, And it was the first thing. I was so excited when I went to my meeting. I shared it at the meeting because I had never thought or done anything for myself until I got sober. My brother and my father did everything. If something needs fixed or whatever. It was like, this little ashtray was the first thing that I took care of myself. And it was very important to me. And that has stayed with me throughout my sobriety is to fix my things. Some things I'm better than others, but it's to take care of myself. That's been very important to me. When I was drinking, I don't even know where to begin here, but my daily drinking started in Europe, in Switzerland, because, it's the cafes. I mean, I'll meet you at the cafe. I mean, could there be anything more, and plus you didn't meet at people's homes. People in Europe don't do that. You meet at the cafe. So there was this place, and I just heard from somebody I went to school with last night from Facebook. They Facebooked me. And this was 1967. You had the greatest beer in the entire world. Anyway, this place, Le Jour et Nuit, which I was there every night. So what I wanted to say was I'm sorry, I'm all over the place. I'm going to get back to where I started, that with this authoritative family, why that's important is because when I had my first drink, at 15, it was, and I thought I was drinking rum and coke. I thought I was drinking coke, but I was drinking rum and coke. I said, whatever in this coke, I want another one. And it relaxed me, for the first time in my life, I was relaxed. I was calm. And I was at this guy's house, it was a little party, and it was the guy's father that was giving the drinks. And I got to make out with this guy that I had a crush on for 2 years. So come on, how good is this rum and coke? And that guy I'm still friendly with, too. alcohol worked for me. I mean, because I was a nervous wreck. And alcohol worked for me from the beginning. When I went off to college, I had a blind date. And this guy didn't know who he was going to get on the blind date, so he had a bottle of, it was Canadian Club, and he made me a drink, in this gigantic glass, half Canadian Club, and then half soda. And again, wow, this stuff is great. And this guy went to Villanova. I went to school right near Villanova, but I went to a small girls' school, and I was only allowed out on Wednesday night and the weekends. So I drank Wednesday night and the weekends. And then I did that for 2 years, and I came back to New York, and I came for a year, and that's when substances came in the picture, and I went off to Europe. And so I was duck takes to water. I loved alcohol. I was also, had pretty low self-esteem. Because I don't mean to get off on this, but when you grow up not knowing you have an independent thought, I was very susceptible to whatever was around me. So I stayed in Europe for 2 years. I came home and I took a geographic to Colorado. And got into heavy narcotics in Colorado. I knew I was going to die if I stayed there long, and I left there. And this is when I date my higher power being in my life, but not knowing it. I was standing on a corner, and two guys I had never met in my life, I couldn't tell you their names now, said they were driving to New York. And I just said to these strangers, do you have room for a third person? Because I knew that I was going to die if I stayed there. I don't know that I cared so much about dying, but I just knew this, I wasn't in a good scene. And these guys took me back to New York. It was amazing. But that's when I really date my knowledge that there was a power greater than myself in my life, whether I knew it or not, that he got me back to New York. Because I would have died if I stayed there. So I think I was home like just a couple of months. I got hepatitis, which we now know is hepatitis C, only we didn't know it then. And I was in my house for like 3 months withdrawing from all this stuff. I got a job in advertising, and I found my niche. Like what you see in Mad Men, that show, it's really true. It's insane. It's crazy. It's fun, when it was fun then. But, you know, so it was all centered around drinking. And I fit right in. And I loved it. Until one night, I was in this bar on 71st and 1st in New York. It was called September's. It was a big advertising hangout. And I fell. And ha ha ha, it's very funny. The next night, the same exact thing happened. I fell, only this time it wasn't funny to me. This time I fell because I knew I was a drunk. And this was probably the beginning of the bottom that might have lasted a couple of years. I don't remember the year this was. But I mean, I knew then that I was a drunk. And when I would go to your house, I would have to bring, I brought a bottle for me, a bottle for you, but you didn't get to drink your bottle. I mean, I drank it. I mean, I couldn't, if the bartender went to the other side of the bar, I had to have a backup. I would be like a wreck. You know, we went to after hours places. I started drinking at this bar on 76th Street. I lived on 80th Street, and I had to take a cab home. You know, it was, I couldn't find my way. I couldn't walk. I'm going to get to sobriety soon, in a minute, but I mean, I was in very precarious situations. I was found one night on the street. I was sleeping on the street, and it was only, you know, I just knew a lot of people in the neighborhood, and this cop came and saw me and took me to my house. And I think I was dating a cop at the time, and he called him. We just found your girlfriend on the street. Can you imagine how embarrassing that? I mean, thank God I was in a blackout, because the only reason why I knew something happened was because when I came into the kitchen, there were three coffee cups in the kitchen. I'm going, what is that? Why is there three coffee cups? I soon found out why there were three coffee cups. So, anyway, that guy, though, shouldn't have talked either, because he was in his cups, too. But anyway, because I didn't go out with anybody who didn't, I mean, who would go out with me who didn't drink like I did, you know? But everybody I knew drank this way, whether they were in advertising or whether they were in the local bar. You know, everybody drank that way. And so what happened was my world got smaller and smaller, and I went on like a 2-week binge or a 3-week binge where I didn't even go to work. I didn't call in. I just was drinking. And what happened was the woman that I was working for had been in AA. I mean, I didn't know this at the time. She had been in AA but stopped going because she was smoking pot. And she knew that you couldn't be high and sober at the same time, and she'd stop going to meetings. But when I was on this three-week binge, she knew what was happening to me. And, like, didn't fire me, or, you know, she just knew what was going on. And, you know, this is a little foggy. We're talking 37 years ago. But I know I didn't get fired then. And I think she probably had a talk with me. So what really happened, though, was I just went on my merry way drinking and not thinking about anything. But I started having personality changes where I could be talking to you, like, calmly 1 minute, and the next minute I was like a raving lunatic. And December 4th was a Monday, so this must be December 1st. I was in this bar that I always went to, and I got into this gigantic fight with this guy. I think it was about baseball. And, you know, I would fight about things that had no meaning or just meant nothing. So the next morning I woke up and I went and I said, well, I better go back. And, well, I had to have a little bit of the hair of the dog. And I better, like, let me find out what I did and get it over with. And so I went back in the bar, and the guy was going, oh, you were so funny last night. But just like that time I fell in the bar, I knew it wasn't funny at all. And my mother had given me the name of a therapist. And so I went to her. And it was like I was going to decide, like I had that attitude of, I'm going to decide if I'm going to let her help me, you know, like, so I went to see this woman, and I saw her for like a couple of times, and like I saw her twice a week. One time, during the day I'd be sober on Monday, but at night when I went, I'd already be drunk by the time I got to her. But after this particular weekend, I was like having tremendous anxiety attacks. But what I realized now, I realized it was withdrawal, but I didn't know that then. And I'm in her office, and she just looked at me and said, Bonnie, don't you think it's time? And I didn't have to ask her, like, time for what? You know, I knew what she meant. We called AA from her office. She was not in AA. Called AA from her office, and she's whispering in my ear, ask them if they have any meetings for people in advertising. So I asked, and this woman, like, yelled at me and said, look, lady, all you need to be is a drunk. And it was the perfect thing to say to me, because I grew up in a house where if you say pass the salt, you're like screaming at the person. Like, nobody talked in a normal tone of voice. Everything was like screaming and yelling. So this woman yelled at me. It was like, oh, I know how to deal with this. I said, all right, so give me the meeting. You know, it was like perfect. So, you know, my feelings at this time was I was very lonely. I was walking around with tears in my eyes. I was lost, and I guess a part of me knew it, that I was lost. But I would pray that I would get some disease, so I would have to go to the hospital. But little did I know that I had a disease. And I had overdosed a couple of times in that year or two. And so that night I went to my first meeting, and I took a deep breath. I had to walk up the stairs, and I took a deep breath, and I said to myself, well, here goes. Because I already couldn't look a bag lady in the eye, because I assumed that was going to be me. I knew I was on my way downtown, the Bowery, because I had to call a friend up in Texas to get, because I had spent my rent money, and he wired me some money. But I knew, I mean, I'm not stupid, I knew I couldn't do that every month. So I knew that I was, like, in bad shape, but I didn't quite know what to do about it. And people I knew had started telling me I should go to AA, but I couldn't connect this AA with me. I just couldn't connect it. I didn't really get it. So I took a deep breath, and I walked up these stairs, and there was a meeting going on, and it was a traditions meeting. Every Monday till this day, this group has a traditions meeting, but I didn't know they were talking English. Like, I thought it was a foreign language they were talking. This woman took me by the hand and took me a couple of blocks to a beginner's meeting. And in this cab ride, now, I don't know anything about AA, nothing. In this cab ride, this woman said to me, I have to hide. This is what you say to somebody taking them to their first meeting. She said, I have to go home and hide all my AA literature because my parents are coming over and they don't know I'm in AA. Now, here I am, like, probably still hung over from the night before. But I knew there was something wrong with this picture. You know, I knew it. And I had hung out with a lot of gangsters. I mean, there's a lot of things I'm leaving out here. But I had hung out with a lot of gangsters, and I had a gun in my house. I mean, I had my house was a bookie place. People called for bets, and it was quite a scene. And but when that woman said that, I knew that it was like for me, it was over. Like, I was not going to lie, cheat, or steal. And I don't know how I knew that, but on a gut level, I mean, I just knew that I was not, that it was over, that those days were over. And I went to my first meeting, and this guy said how he doesn't call his sponsor. Now, I didn't know what any of this meant, but this guy said he doesn't call his sponsor, but when he gets drunk, he calls Alaska. And for some reason, I thought that was like the funniest thing I ever heard. and I started laughing, as did other people in the room. I guess it was like the way he said it. But it was like, wow, what's this sound coming out of my, you know, self? Because I probably hadn't laughed in years. I didn't go to a movie in years because I didn't think of bringing liquor with me to the movie. Don't ask me why. I told you I didn't think before I got sober. But I didn't think of that. So I didn't go to a movie. I didn't go to any place where I couldn't, like, the alcohol wasn't an arm's length away from me. So here I am, like, laughing at this meeting. And that was December 4th, 1978. And it's been my little love affair since then. I mean, I loved AA from the minute I went because, like, I intuitively knew in that cab ride, I just intuitively knew that I wasn't going to get sober sitting home watching television, and I couldn't even watch television at that point. I would see everything in double. When you were talking to me, by the time you finished your sentence, I didn't know what the beginning of it was. So I just knew that, and I can't tell you even truthfully why I wanted to get sober, like sitting here. I just knew I was miserable. And I was sick, truly, truly sick and tired of being sick and tired. That's not a cliche for me. Those slogans aren't cliches for me. I lived by them. That's how I got through every single day, was keep it simple, first things first, right? What's the first thing I have to do? I mean, I lived the slogans and what you tell me in meetings. So I would go to a beginner's meeting, and then the way they did it, then there was another meeting. And I went to like two meetings a day or three, because I would go to a lunchtime meeting. On weekends, I could go to four weekends on a Saturday, four meetings on a Saturday, because we'd start at the 10, go to the 12, and go to the 3, and then there's a 6:15, and again the 10. I mean, that's what we did, the people. And I have to tell you that 36 years later, I would say 95% of the people I got sober with are still sober, and I'm still in contact with most of them. Because we just immersed ourselves in meetings. I guess living in Manhattan, it's really like a small little town. And that's what, that's the only time I felt any sanity was in a meeting. And so when I was 90 days sober, I got a special dispensation. They asked me to be the beginner's liaison, because you're supposed to be 6 months, but they let me do it. And I thought I was like invited to the prom. Like, I ran home and called my sponsor, who said I gave her a headache. That my enthusiasm for the program gave her a headache. So we know that didn't last too long. But one thing about my sponsor, I met her. She had been dating, she married a guy that I knew that I had hung out with in one of these dive bars. And one at her engagement party in this dive bar, really dive, can't get much divier. I'm crying to her that I don't know what's wrong with my life. And when this was 3 years later, I see her at that first AA meeting I went to when I left. And she ran up to me and said, "Bonnie, I've been looking for you. I found out what's wrong with your life." You know, it was like... So she became my first sponsor. But as I said, my enthusiasm gave her a headache. That's a quote. Anyway, I had no problem. I loved this thing. It was great stories you hear. They all have a happy ending. And after I was a year sober, I started going to step meetings and go... I haven't stopped, you know, because the program is the steps, and I didn't do my fourth step, you know, I didn't go to rehab, so it's a little different. I did my fourth step and fifth step when I was like a year and 11 months sober, and I did it because I couldn't stand it anymore. And once I did it, I really felt this sense of belonging, and it really worked for me. I mean, when I didn't have like that white light experience, but what I noticed a couple of months after I did my fifth step was that I call it this Christmas, this Santa Claus bag of guilt was, you know, had left, you know, it gradually left. And I've led my life where no matter what is going on, Alcoholics Anonymous is first and foremost. And there were things and relationships I gave up along the way because there was this one guy I was crazy about, but he liked to smoke. And, you know, like, I might have been pissed at the moment. There were a couple of times I was pissed at the moment and really angry, but I knew nothing. I believed everything that was said to me. When you said to me, "Anything you put in front of AA, you're going to lose." I mean, I believed it. I believe what those who, thank God, I don't know how, I didn't believe anything my parents said to me. But I believed what, when you, alcoholics had gone before me, I believed what you said. And I followed the guidelines of what, to the best of my ability. I'm not saying I'm a saint, trust me. But, I have never compromised on the tenets of what I see of Alcoholics Anonymous, and sometimes, you know, you're when you have your own opinion that goes against other opinions, sometimes it's very lonely. You're alone in the crowd, but as long as I know it's the right thing for my sobriety, that's what's important to me, and I stick to that, no matter what. So along the way, I have like 2 minutes left, or what time do we stop? 8:30?
8:45.
Along the way, I had six different majors when I went to school earlier on. So when I got sober, I went back to school. I graduated from college, and then I went to graduate school, and I graduated from graduate school. And I had to get tutors and stuff, like in the beginning of college, math stuff. But I wound up being on the dean's list, graduating. Well, I was very happy about that. And I went, as I said, to graduate school. And then I was getting my PhD. And I did all the work for my PhD. And by the way, when I went to graduate school, I waitressed in a bar. And there were nights where, like, I would bring a beer to a table and I wanted to slurp that head off that beer. But I kept saying that my primary, you know, this is what I got out of the book, Living Sober, that it's one of my motives. You know, I'm always looking at, like, what are my motives? My motives for that job was pure, I felt, because it got me, I was able to go full-time to graduate school. And tell you the truth, I had a ball in the restaurant because it was the only time I got to socialize. Like, I wasn't doing a paper or stuff. I had a lot of fun. But I stayed 2 years too long. Like, when I graduated, I stayed another 2 years because I liked it. But it was time to leave. So then I eventually went to NYU to get my PhD, and I finished all my classes, and I started writing my dissertation, and 9/11 happened, and I was a social worker for the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. So I was, like, right there, and for the next 2.5 months, my job was to work at the pier. And I loved, my assignment was to work with the cops and the firemen. Now, you could just imagine how thrilled they were to talk to me. You know, they wanted no part of me. But, so they had this special place, like, with just food, and so I was just like a presence there, whatever. But it was, it changed my life. Because every day I would leave there really very, very upset. I mean, this is like an understatement. You know, because I also talked to family members who lost people, and it was a very intense time. And I could not focus after that. My priorities totally shifted in my life. It was like, do I want to spend time with my family and friends, or do I want to sit home and write a paper? You know, write my paper. First of all, I couldn't even focus. So 2 years after that, I withdrew, and I'm, you know, okay with it. It had to be that way. And so I would say that there are a couple of life-changing moments in my life. One was getting sober, of course, and that was another big, it just changes you. You know, trauma changes you. And I had decided, for a long time I wanted to move to Florida. You know, it was always in the back of my mind. So, and part of the vicissitudes of living life is, you know, my parents died, and after my mom died, I, you know, was free to move to Florida. And that guy that I had made out with, that first drink, I was coming to Florida specifically that time to, he lived in Orlando, was to move in with him. And so I had taken my Florida license test and everything, and then we had a big fight. He hung up the phone on me, and I didn't speak to him for 11 months later. And I knew it. I knew when he hung up the phone, I knew that was it. You know, and I have to say that I think after my mom died, you know, it became real. Like, oh my God, this is real now. I got to break up with her. So So, I mean, it's all okay, and we're still friends. We're friends. It's all. And listen, I dodged a bullet because he's been in California growing and selling marijuana. I mean, in a trillion billion years, I couldn't have gone there. So I always say, like, well, see, my higher power always knows better than me. So my grounding, no matter what is going on in my life, my grounding is Alcoholics Anonymous. When my parents died, it's interesting, my mother and my father died on the exact same day. Like, but my father in 2001 and my mother in 2009. I mean, I think that's, like, amazing. But whenever, and when good things happen, when sad things happen, I always, a meeting is the first place I go. And on both those occasions, I mean, that's where I belong. That's where I'm going to get what I need, and I'm going to talk to people in AA. Like, when I was going to school, I mean, I'm sure the people at New York were like, I hope she graduates soon because we can't hear about this anymore. Because everything would make me very anxious, and when I'm anxious, I have to talk about it. But I got through everything that I've done in my life, I've gotten through with the help of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've gone to every international convention since 1985, and if you haven't been, at least go one time, because it's quite a phenomenal experience. And I've been active in AA ever since I got sober. In New York, I was active in general service, and here we call it, I don't know, the district. But it's just a way for me to give back, you know, and I like being involved. The move to Florida was very, very difficult for me emotionally. I mean, I was like a newcomer again. And trust me, it's very different here than New York. I mean, the first couple of meetings, I ran home and called my friends and cried. And my first sponsee, her name is Mindy, who next week is going to be sober 35 years. She's in L.A., and she would say to me, Bonnie, could you just try and make friends? Could you just, like, go back, like, to, because, you know, I would come home, I'm going, Mindy, I can't take it. And she go, just try not to antagonize everybody in the room, because she knew me, you know, just try and be nice and, you know, make some friends. You know, it was very funny. But it was a gigantic adjustment for me. And I was smart enough to know, like, you're not the ones that have to change. I'm the one that had to change. So I have to tell you, it's been a wonderful experience for me, because you guys are much more into the big book. We're in New York much more into the 12 and 12. But I've learned so much about the big book, and I love, my favorite meeting is I go to the history meeting on Wednesday night that Sandy did, and now we're continuing it. I love that meeting. And so being, how does it work? Open, honest, and willing. I mean, I've been very challenged these last 5 years, but it's all been for my personal growth. So no matter what, it's been wonderful. And I'm moving again. I'm moving December 4th, the day of my anniversary. I'm moving to Venice, Florida, where I have two friends that I know for like 30 years. And so I'm going to be off to another adventure. And now, like, driving here tonight, like, I was a little sad because now I know all these shortcuts how to get here. And it's like, yeah, I'm just could do the shortcut and now I'm leaving. But in a way, like, isn't that what life is about? That, you know, when we always have to be moving forward and growing and learning. And when I was new, there was this woman who lives in the Villages now, who I think she was 11 months sober. No, this is the same woman, but this was a few years later. And she would talk about being complacent. And I would sit in the meetings and like pray that I never get complacent, because I know me. You know, I, one of those six times six majors, I was going to school with a class I liked, abnormal psychology. I loved it. And they called it nuts and sluts. Like, you know, I loved the class. I missed it once, I never went back. So you see, I know that about myself. So when I go to a meeting, I sit in the front, and I can't, even to this day, I mean, I can't miss a meeting, because, I mean, when I was in New York, there were, and I did have two jobs, and there were times I only went to the meetings on weekends, but in my heart, I was always in a meeting. And here, since I moved to Florida, I think I must go at least five or six times a week. But it's, I don't care how, I need the meetings. You know, I'm not somebody who thinks that I've got it together. You know, it's very important for me to be involved in AA and speak, because I'm so grateful. I have stuff to give, but I have so much to get, because trust me, I learn from everybody. And you know, in New York, I didn't realize how sheltered I was. You know, you just know your little enclave. And I've met people here from parts of the country that I'll tell you, I read about in books, like that I had no idea, like there were real people there. And so it's been for me a tremendous learning experience, and my prayer is I never stop learning, and I thank you all for my sobriety.